Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me as always is a man whose mama raised him on huge slabs of meat. He is the Big Captain.
Thank you. It's good to be seen and it's good to see you. Cheers, mates.
And it's still snowing. Tonight we are drinking Lizard of Kaz by Founders Brewing Company in beautiful Grand Rapids, Michigan. Garage grade, 5 out of 5 bottle caps. I love this stuff, Captain. This beer is perfect for the winter months. I like to start off my Friday night with one of these on draft at my favorite spot. Lizard of Kaz is packed with great flavor. It's a complex beer, but it has to be to mask the 10.5 ABV.
You should tell the listeners your favorite spot so they show up.
I'm not going to do that. But you wouldn't even know or detect the high ABV because Lizard of Kaz is full of chocolate, vanilla, and wonderful Michigan blueberries aged in oak barrels. And this fantastic brew is brought to us by this fantastic crew.
You see what you did there?
First up, we have Big Pete from York, England. Big Pete says, I hope you can make it over to the UK when the Browns play in London. Well, I'd love to do something like that. Captain, you're very well traveled. Have you ever been to London?
Yes.
I went
every weekend.
Every weekend. I went there once on a shorter trip than I would have liked. London is a great place to which everyone should experience. Next up, we have Cassandra in Seattle who says, try some Elysian Split Shot. That's an espresso milk stout from Seattle.
And her name was Cassandra.
Next, we have M&L Recruiting in Massachusetts. Let's go to Oregon City and say hi to Mark. Also, all the way in Berlin, Germany, we say hi and thanks to Laura. And I would like to give a thank you to Angela in Australia who sent us a wonderful Christmas package with a really cool Australian beer koozie.
It was full on, man.
It was full on. We've practically been adopted by Australia. The listeners don't know that, but
yeah,
that's where I'm fleeing to when the stuff hits the fan.
They want to make our show a TV show, and they also gave me a job.
So the fallout plan for the garage is Australia, is what we're saying.
Right, we're heading down under.
So we want to thank everybody for pitching in for the beer fund this week. And if you want to kick it up and buy us some beers for next week, go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
And for everything social media, you can follow us at Snapchat, Facebook, Untappd, all that stuff, Instagram. I got a little Instagram bet with my buddy that I can't get to a certain number by my birthday. So let's make that happen. And you can do so at True Crime Garage. And that's enough of the business.
And enough of Australia as well. So gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer, and let's talk some true crime. Hold on, man. Captain, are you ready? Are you holding on to your seat? Because we are going to do a quick update show.
I'm holding on to something.
This is a case that we've covered maybe more than any other case. We've done a few episodes on this one. Way back in season one, we covered the Long Island serial killer case and managed to accuse many people along the way of having been the actual killer. Or at least maybe you should talk to them a little further. But we will not let this case rest. And anytime there's a new development, we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk to each other. And we also asked for the wonderful Joshua Zeman and Rachel Mills, who did a fantastic job on the show Killing Season. I hope everybody checked that out, because that was about the Long Island serial killer case as well as other cases throughout the country. I thought it was one of the best documentaries that's come out in recent past. And we've asked them to join us to talk about some of these recent developments.
Right, and currently it's on Amazon. So I'll put a link in the show description so you guys can check that out if you haven't already. One of the greatest things about this documentary is at the end of every episode, they hook you.
Yeah.
And they do. I don't know if it was Josh. I'm just going to assume it wasn't Josh, and this was Rachel's doing. I'm going to give her the props for that. But it's at the end of each episode, you're like, okay, well, maybe I'll watch the next one. But then they hook you, and then you go, I have to watch the next one. This is a very easy show to binge watch.
Yeah. The really cool thing here, too, is they got the web sleuth community involved in the show.
Yeah, very cool.
And, you know, I really actually thought that was going to be a cheesy thing, not because of the web sleuth thing. I'm a web sleuther myself. I've been active on there
for a few
years. We're not going to talk about that. but if you're on there, it's not hard to figure out who I am. But the thing here is, though, I'm glad that they got him involved. But the thing that was really cool was the web sleuthers that came forward that they actually had on audio or video. They had some amazing theories, like some really good stuff to check out there. And the great thing about Killing Season...
Well, some of it is just not theories. Some of it is just a great insight and actual knowledge. I mean, it's just not just some speculation.
The other thing I loved about Killing Season was, about 8 episodes?
Mm-hmm.
I think during the course of those 8 episodes, there's about 3 or 4 really sketchy dudes that they come across that you're like, oh my God, this guy, he's either the killer that they're looking for, or he's done something that we should lock him up for. So check out the Killing Season, available on Amazon.
So a couple things happened with this documentary. One, they dove into new information. They try to uncover as much as they could. But during the course of filming and editing, a couple things came out in this case that we want to talk about in the news.
And we're going to take you down some different roads with these new developments in the Long Island Gilgo serial murder case. But we're also going to take you down a different road on how we typically do these shows. I know that typically with an interview show, it's usually just me and the interviewees. However, there were some conversations that I wanted to have been had between the captain and I regarding this ongoing investigation.
Yeah, so it just goes between a little bit of the interview, and then we go back to talking. So anyways, we'll see you in a little bit, and let's check in with Josh and Rachel.
First off, congratulations on the show. Killing Season was recently on A&E, but I'm wondering, how long ago were you done with the production of the show? And there's been developments in the case since then. Did you remain involved in the investigation?
That's a great question. Officially, I guess you can say that we were done filming last year, in January of this past year of 2016. But editing process takes a long time, and with active investigations, things can happen. And as we were finishing up, literally episode 8, things broke May of 2006 in Long Island, and that was the county executive saying that he was demanding SPOTA's resignation. Now, that hasn't happened. SPOTA's still in leadership, but that was interesting. So we had to open the edit back up and make sure we would be able to include that into the last episode.
That was literally the last day of editing.
Right.
This, you have the highest elected official demanding the resignation of the district attorney in part by what happened in the Gilgo case. So we were just, you know, kind of flabbergasted that it was still it was always happening, you know, and it's always been happening, and it continues to be so. It's a case that really just doesn't stop.
One very fascinating part of The Killing Season was that you chose to work with the Web Sleuth community. Now, I'm a big fan of Web Sleuths. What was your takeaway from working with the participants?
Well, you know, the Web Sleuths are an interesting group. It was really interesting. We wanted, as kind of journalists, to look at what, not only look at like what the case, what was happening with the case, but look at what was most interesting to the Web Sleuth community. You know, in a lot of ways, we wanted to make a true crime show for true crime junkies, you know? And the best way to do that was really to go to Web Sleuths. And also, like, they had kind of done their own sleuthing. And so we wanted to pick up where that left off. Now, the interesting thing is, like, the Web Sleuth community is, like, you know, they're very particular. You know, you've got some really interesting folks on there, all different backgrounds, all different styles, all different, like, levels of, like, you know, communication. And so it was very interesting. I think people were skeptical, though, at first. They definitely didn't want to reveal who they were to us, right, Rach? You know, everybody's like, wouldn't you say they were very nervous up front?
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to hide behind a handle or a screen name. There's some security in that. So for two filmmakers to come in and kind of, you know, communicate with them and try to get them on board, it took a little bit of convincing. But,
yeah, on film.
Yeah,
they were like, no, I don't want to go on film.
Yeah.
I was like, you've got such great ideas. Come on,
right.
You know. But, you know, it was interesting because that's the whole thing. And that's it's a good question, actually, because it's really like, it's about trying to bring the case out from the shadows, out from, like, behind the veneer of, like, the cable pundit, like the Nancy Graces, and really try and, like, empower people, just regular citizens, to do things.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's interesting with the Web Sleuth community and going down the rabbit hole of all the Long Island serial killer forums on that site. Some of the bigger issues or the holes in the case, from a public standpoint, from a Web Sleuther standpoint, kind of rises to the top. And that definitely came out when we discovered through Web Sleuth, through field notes, that the mother of the toddler was not in Namath. I think it would have taken us much longer to figure that out.
And if field notes hadn't said anything.
If he hadn't said anything, and then to really understand what that means, what are the repercussions of not having her in Namath. And now, spoiler alert, fast forward, you know, to a couple of weeks ago, now that she is in Namath because of our communication, Josh and myself and Todd Matthews, working with the medical examiner's office in Nassau, is that now she is in Namath. And we thought we were just going to, you know, we wanted to make sure that happened. We knew we probably wouldn't catch the serial killer, right? But we can do something small. However, that small thing has now kind of been the biggest break in the case.
In years.
Development in the case.
Yeah.
Since April 2011.
It was really like the last little thing on our note, like, oh, let's get Jane Doe number 3, who's the mother of the toddler. Just to back up a little bit, of the bodies that were found along Ocean Parkway, there was a mother and a toddler. And nobody quite knows, like, toddler, what's a toddler doing there? These are all sex workers. You know, and it's a big question. Is it a sex worker who brings a baby along on a trick, which we now know actually happens quite a bit? We didn't think so. Or, as some people have said, you know, is this a different sort of relationship? And this is like somebody who the killer or killers knew, and, you know, could this even be the wife and the child? So this mother and toddler who are found is very, very interesting because that, like, gives you a lot of clues to go off of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just give birth without there being a lot of records, you know. So, you know, a lot of these victims are really, like, under-the-radar sex workers, and now we've got a mother and toddler. So it's really interesting for a lot of people. But the really strange thing is we thought that the killer was being really devious, and this is one reason why people thought it was law enforcement, was because the person who dumped the bodies intentionally separated the mother and the child, left the child basically next to another body, who's known as Jane Doe number 6, and and dumped the mother literally across the county line in Nassau County. Now, all these unidentified victims that are found on the Suffolk County side of this crime scene are in Namus. But for some reason, Nassau County wasn't putting this Jane Doe in. And from that, you know, we just emailed him and he said, oh, we can't put this person in because these body parts here, I think it was like
extremities.
Mother's, yeah. You know, they're like, oh, we can't put these bodies here. We can't put this, we can't create a record for this victim because the victim is already in Namus. And we're like, what do you mean? And they're like, actually, we've linked this victim to another victim named Peaches. Now, Rach and I knew quite a bit about Peaches because Peaches was another victim, a dismembered torso that was found 40 miles east in Hempstead. But we, you know, when this case rolled around, we were looking at all the dismembered bodies around, and you know, you would think there's not that many, but actually, there's a lot of dismemberment. You know, the question is whether or not it's a forensic countermeasure to prevent identification, or is this somebody who's like enjoying dismembering somebody, as Peter Brent had suggested with some of the bodies found in Long Island. So as a result, it's now basically been proven that if Jane Doe number 3 is linked to Peaches, in fact, the body parts of the same victim, which we now know through DNA, this completely extends the forensic footprint of the killer. The killer is now just, killer or killers has now not just dumped bodies in Manorville and Gilgo Beach. He has also dumped a body in Hempstead. And that is 40 miles even like closer to New York City. So now you start to put your thinking cap on and say, is this guy from New York City? Is he live more towards Queens? You know, it really changes everything. And the disturbing part is that Suffolk County apparently knew this and Nassau County knew that this victim was linked, but didn't tell anybody. And that's what I think we found so interesting. I mean, it's not this game of trying to get information out of the police. It's kind of more frustration of why the police aren't being as forthright as possible. And if the answer is, well, there's an active serial killer now roaming around two counties, I get it, but I don't know. I mean, you would think the public deserves to know. So that's where we stand with at least that side of the new developments.
Do we have a known cause of death for either Peaches or the toddler, or at least how the remains were found?
Well, you know, first of all, just to go even further with why it's so interesting, do you want to say the 97 versus 96 and how that totally changes? So the other thing is Peaches was found in a Rubbermaid tub off a trail in a state park, but it's really like a very kind of, it's not really a park.
No, but, and also just in case you forget, was found probably within 3 days of having been murdered.
Right. Which is very important. Yeah. So this body, it's a torso, dark skinned person. There's a tattoo of a peach on it. And it's just a torso, literally the midsection.
Yeah.
No arms, no legs, no head. And you know, the way it was presented, being found in this Rubbermaid tub, there's the idea, this is something that web sleuther Peter Brent brings up, you know, it was kind of placed there to be found. And so it's more than just forensic countermeasures when you're chopping up this body. It's also, there's a little bit of a, look at what I've done and see how horrific I am. But the most interesting thing is this body was found in 97. Now, going back to the bodies that are found along Gilgo Beach and in Manorville, the earliest one was 96. That person is known as Fire Island Jane Doe. In 1996, a pair of severed legs washed up in a plastic bag on Fire Island. That was in 96. And then in 2011, they found the rest of this woman's remains on Gilgo Beach. Now, we didn't quite know, was this person really connected? You know, this is one of the things that maybe if you think there's numerous different killers around there and everybody's just using this area as a dumping ground, you know, maybe it's three. But now, when you have this woman's severed legs found in 96 and then this torso found in 97, you start to put it all together and you start to see a little bit more. You know, go ahead.
Yeah, well, then and just in addition to that, there was that gap between 96 and arguably 2000 with
right.
Jane Doe number 6
right.
and Jessica Taylor in 2003. And then fast forward to 2007 when the first of the Gilgo Beach 4 went missing, which was 2007, and that was Marine. So having Peaches now directly linked to Gilgo puts, you know, brings everything back a little bit. 97.
Right. Well, now you say, well, the 96, okay, 96,
right,
97,
yeah.
2000, 2003,
right.
2007. Like, it starts to fill in, and then where you have these periodical gaps, and you're like, no,
right.
this can't be the same guy. Suddenly, you know, there's a difference between a 4-year gap and a 3-year gap. You know what I'm saying? And so it really brings into question, like, is it, now we debate back and forth. Maybe it is one killer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've definitely now started to say, like, wow, you know. So that was, I think, the biggest revelation on the body side. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say Todd Matthews has been working with us very closely.
Todd Matthews is
the director of the media director?
Media director.
Of NAMIS, which is the public database, yes.
Who happens to be his own.
He started out as wasn't a web sleuther back then, but it was a.
From the Doe Network.
Yeah, from the Doe Network.
Yeah, he's very interesting because he's the guy who discovered who Tech Girl was.
Right.
And that was his own case for like 20 years. So he's a citizen sleuther as well who's now running the director of communications for NAMIS. So really,
right.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, no, it's great. But I bring him up and I bring this process up because we've been working with him very closely for the past, I mean, for years, but
yeah.
very heavily the past month. And between all our work, got the mother of the toddler into NAMIS. And Todd, through conversations that I've had with him, feels this is big progress. And
right.
I think he is now going to put more energy from his side into looking at the rest of the unidentified
and
more
say,
active.
When you say more energy from his side, which is just like maybe tasking a couple more people with making sure that all the biometrics are in, like the dental records
right.
and everything.
But and there's also ways that they can work with DNA as well. They
right.
can be more, they can outreach more to possible people who could be connected and
right.
do that. I don't want to say too much about it, but
right.
That should be coming sometime soon.
So, you know, it's just very interesting. We got in this, just all we wanted to do was really bring attention to this case and maybe try and identify somebody. We've always said that it's identification of these unidentified, which is really, you know, the key to solving this case. But also, I think it's the key to empowering people. Like,
mm-hmm.
if you're listening to this show and you're interested in true crime, you know, and you're like, well, I'm not going to be a cop. But you can actually go out there on web sleuth. You can actually identify.
Yeah.
You can help identify. And you can make a huge, major break in a case.
Well, look, just today I'm going to bring up the pillowcase.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah
so
yeah.
literally coming back from, you know, holiday weekend, I go onto web sleuth and I see that my inbox is full from people saying, did you see about the pillowcase? Did you see about the pillowcase? I go online. And the web sleuther. So just to back up, when Peaches was found in that Rubbermaid container back in 97, a pillow sham and a towel was found with her. And no one had figured out like where those came from or like had done the really deep work to see, you know, who was the manufacturer, where may have someone bought that in Long Island or New York back, you know, circa 90 to 97.
Right.
So they actually were able to trace it back and have discovered that it was manufactured, I believe, between 90 and 95.
Okay.
By a certain manufacturer that only sold to these places. So right now, as we're speaking, they're hard at work at figuring out and cross-referencing where that, what store may that have come from.
Right.
Now, that might sound not significant, but
everything's significant.
Yeah, we didn't know that putting the mother of the child in NamUs was going to be as significant as it was. You just never know.
Right, you never know, right? So now it's like, okay, like, did he get it at Macy's in, like, the Roosevelt Mall? You know, like, all these things are going to point to where the footprint of the killer is. And when you're talking about geoprofiling, you know, that all, if that becomes really significant. So that's one kind of big update.
If I could just say real fast, that kind of specific information is what web sleuthers do so great.
Yeah.
And where I understand law enforcement not wanting to include web sleuthers, you know, in all these investigations. I understand their hesitation. But for instance, if they had gone, and they might know this information already, we don't know. But if they have information like that, of like, let's figure out where this object was from, they could save so much manpower because they're as we always say, they're overworked and underpaid. So those are the kinds of things that they're super good at.
All right, we'll get back to our interview with Joshua and Rachel right after this quick beer break.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Everyone is still talking about Monopoly Go for a good reason. It is an absolute hit. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Like countless crazy tournaments, you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Or timed events, offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums. Delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches. Unique playing pieces and so much more. The verdict is in. With Monopoly Go, there's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now free on the App Store and Google Play.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage. Today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out BetterHelp.com/garage today.
The best part of spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless. When Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. It's time to switch to Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. Save a lot of money with Mint Mobile. Get their great mobile wireless service delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. That's premium service at a great price. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, Fees and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Meet your wellness goals in time for summer thanks to the menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great-tasting meals. With 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. Crush your wellness goals this May with dietitian-approved meals and ingredients that you can trust. Make your day delicious, from breakfast to dessert. Stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. Treat yourself to restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon. I am new to Factor, and I have been loving every minute of it. I have a problem, and it's called lunch. Some days I need a pack of lunch, and some days I work from home. Whether I'm at home or whether I'm on the go, Factor is fueling my lunch from now on. Head to factormeals.com/truecrimegarage50 and use code truecrimegarage50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code truecrimegarage50 at factormeals.com/truecrimegarage50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
All right, and we're back from our beer break.
You have got to get the public involved when it comes to these cases, especially cold cases. Mm-hmm. And we have seen with cases that we've recently covered, we covered the Jacob Wetterling case a couple weeks ago, and we saw in that case, it's 27 years old, and a blogger gets involved and starts piecing together crimes that were related to the Jacob Wetterling case. And what I'm getting at here is that it seems almost shameful to me. I understand that law enforcement needs to hold certain things close to the vest mm-hmm. because they have to be able to verify if a confession is real or not and know if somebody is an actual suspect. But we see something like with the Amy Mihaljevic case. 26 yeah. years after the fact, they come forward and they say, you know what, we found this curtain or we found this rug at the crime scene and we mm-hmm. believe that it's part of the crime scene, that it's part of the victim, that it's linked to the victim here.
Yeah.
Can the public help trace these? Have you seen these before? Did you know anybody that owned this curtain or this rug? But you're asking 26 years later, people move away, people pass away, people forget. Yeah. What is shameful to me is that it's so late in the game. I like with the Lisk investigation that they're coming forward with this information now and asking, do you know about this pillowcase? Let's figure this out. And that's what the Web Sleuth community is so good at.
Well, and I just think the true crime community in general is good at. I mean, we're all armchair detectives. I think that's why we get into the genre, right? So, and then, you know, recently, you know, we covered a case, season one, that, you know, is close to our hometown, but there is some developments that we're trying to make behind the scenes. You know, we haven't really talked about that on the show, but we don't really want to discuss that until there's some validity to what basically you discovered. You know, I can't take a lot of credit for that.
Well, so, but to put to what Josh and Rachel are talking about here, mm-hmm. getting Web Sleuths and Namus involved in these things, we've been working with local law enforcement here and the Namus organization for several months trying to put some things together here. And we're hoping to see some developments in a case that we've worked for.
And I never knew what Namus was.
Okay.
So just explain that to some of the audience listeners that might not know what it is.
So it's not missing persons. It's unidentified remains or unidentified bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so every jurisdiction throughout the country, they find unidentified bodies, Jane Doe's, John Doe's, and they put them into this system. It's called the Namus system because they, you know, the victims want to be named, you know, identify us.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good name for the
system. The Namus system, they are able to put in certain amounts of information regarding these Jane Doe's and John Doe's. And the problem with it is it can be very vague information.
Mm-hmm.
So on a national spectrum, right now it's voluntary. So law enforcement is not required to go in and put anything in there. They're not required to check NamUs. But what has recently developed in this country, which is great, it's a great thing. They tried to get it passed nationally that it would be a required act that law enforcement would be involved in.
They would have to put all this information into the database.
Correct. And right now, what has taken place is there's only two states in the country that have passed this and made it law. Mm-hmm. But it started with Connecticut, and then it moved to New York, where this is now a requirement that they are checking these, that they are putting certain information in there. Now, anybody can go to, and I recommend that you do so, go to NamUs, go to their website, scout around on there and see what's going on in your community, or if there's a case that you're interested in and a missing person or somebody that's been lost for years, right. you can troll through there and figure out what's going on and see if there's any kind of match. Some of the information is vague because this is voluntary. Some of it's very descriptive and detailed. But the thing here is law enforcement and the FBI, they actually have the ability to get onto NamUs, and they can see different information than the general public can. So it's a valuable source. It's a valuable piece that is not required and should, frankly, be required in all states.
Right. Well, yeah, so here's the interesting thing, right? So this all stems from these parents of this guy, Billy Smolinski, who's from Connecticut. And we actually interviewed the Smolinski family. If you go on the A&E site, you can actually see the interview we did the Smolinskis. You can actually even see the work we did on Peaches before we knew, and we didn't include it because we can never like say, oh, she's a definitive victim. And suddenly we find out later when the show's done that Peaches really is a victim. And it's funny because we did all this work to try and find out who she was. So you can actually go on the site and see the additional content about Peaches. But this is – so they were trying to pass a law for years called Billy's Law after this. And basically the whole problem is that this public database isn't – sorry. When missing person information is entered into the database, there's two different databases. There's the database that the police can see, and there's the database that the public can see. And they don't work together. And that's because law enforcement wants to put some information in that they don't want the public to see. But what happens is, no offense to law enforcement or to anybody, but you know, data entry is not law enforcement's strong suit. It's not really anybody's strong suit, pretty much. I don't know. But, you know, these guys are out, like, having to hit the streets and, like, find killers, not hunting and pecking on a computer to type in information. And so as a result, a lot of this kind of missing persons stuff is all, like, you know, just kind of gets messed up. Like, you know, was the person 5'6 or 6'5, you know? Or, you know, were they born in 19, you know, 66, you know, 67 or 76, you know, all these little number changes, you know, are, you know, can totally do it. So, you know, you're never going to be your best advocate. Nobody else is going to be the best advocate except like you, or, you know, if you're a missing person, it's like your family. So they made this law in Connecticut, and Murphy is the guy, the congressman who we interviewed, you know, to try and pass this thing that, you know, they have to put this information publicly. You as a parent need to be able to go in and look at this information and make sure that the information about your missing child is actually correct. Because what they had found out when they went to look is that all the missing person information about their kid was incorrect. And so when it was going through the databases, there was no hits because it was all incorrect. So Connecticut was the first one to pass it. Now, Chris Murphy, interestingly enough, tried to get this bill passed nationally, but anything that's required by law enforcement is not going to pass nationally. So unfortunately, it's died three times now.
Yeah.
And that was really frustrating for us because it was like, come on, it's missing people. You know what I'm saying? Like how, like you put the information there, you know, it's, there's so much tragedy, but unfortunately they did it. And now it's happening through states. And so it was first Connecticut, Chris Murphy, now Cuomo signed it, and that's part of the reason. Part of the reason is, you know, it's by law.
And recently there was an article that is specifically about this case and specifically about Namus. And they're talking about the unidentified deceased missing persons that are out there and how Namus can be involved in this. And the interesting thing here, when we talk about the Long Island serial killer case, this article states that in Nassau County, where bodies were found, we have 11 unidentified deceased persons. Yeah. And in Suffolk County, where some of the other bodies were found in this case, we have 27 unidentified missing person deceased bodies.
Yeah, I mean, that to me, that's a crazy statistic.
Yeah, yeah, it's heavy.
And not only crazy, but that's scary.
It's a heavily populated area, you know, so you might expect a higher number there. However, these are more recent cases. This isn't going back to the beginning of time. This is in more recent times.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of space in Suffolk County. Yeah. There's a lot of woods, you know, but it's like, it's really interesting, you know, as we kind of get more granular with our data. And that's something we try to show in the whole series, whether it's, you know, Tom Hargrove's Murder Accountability Project.
So those who aren't familiar with this, Tom Hargrove was an investigator and he set up...
Investigative journalist.
Yeah, and he set up this nonprofit organization that basically tracks unsolved murders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tracks them nationwide. And actually, when they started putting this data together and collecting it and then cataloging it, once he had put in all that work and all that effort, there was a bit... he was a bit hesitant to release this because I saw an interview with him and he stated, you know, I felt like by releasing this to the public, we're almost saying, you know what, if you want to kill somebody and you want to get away with it, then you can do that in Detroit. You can do that in Chicago. You could probably kill somebody in one of those cities and nobody ever catch you for it. He was worried about that portion of it. However, investigatively and the amount of help that it could do.
Yeah.
In reverse to that is what is much more important and what we're going to see. You know, this is holding local law enforcement accountable. It's not just reading about somebody dying or being found somewhere and then months later you read about somebody else or a year later you read about somebody else. No, it's putting it all together in one place to look at it and say, whoa, 30, that's a high number. Right. 35, that is unacceptable.
And are they connected?
Yeah. Yeah. Do we have a serial killer here, or do we have a group of people doing this? For some reason, these murders are going unsolved, and we've got to hold law enforcement accountable to that.
Yeah, I mean, we are paying their... I mean, I don't want to sound super negative towards law enforcement because I support law enforcement. Obviously, a bunch of friends involved in it, but that's the reason why we have law enforcement. This is the reason why we have taxes in our cities.
And going back to something that Joshua and Rachel were talking about earlier, that's another thing too. You know, when these cases go cold, even if it's just a couple of months, if they've got nothing, if they've got no leads, let's present it to the public. Let's get this crowd sleuthing involved and see how we can take these cases off of our books and put people behind bars.
And like we said before, I mean, we've always joked, you know, the True Crime Garage, but our listeners, we like to call them the True Crime Army. But that's essentially what all these other podcasts and all these documentaries are doing. As it becomes more and more popular genre, you know, there's a lot of intelligent people that dive into these cases as a hobby. And I think we're going to start seeing more and more cases solved, you know, by the True Crime Army.
But, you know, one of the things I wanted to say, which I found so interesting, which we were talking about earlier, which is like when the police come and, you know, say, well, we need help identifying who this individual is, you know, 12 years ago. And you know, it's like, it's weird, but like you almost have to make it, you have to think like a movie or think like, you have to make it engaging for the audience. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're not in the days of, it's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? Or call this face on a milk carton. Or even America's Most Wanted. You know, like it's 2.0. You know, and in the 2.0 world, you have to like make it engaging. Like you have to show people that there things can be done. Like when first you do the TV show, and then we happen to have this little thing. This thing with Peaches, and now everybody is all over this case. And now you really do have people and a chance to actually solve it.
One of the things that I like the most about The Killing Season, and I didn't know this in advance, even having talked to you before the show came out, I didn't realize you were going to travel around the country and check out different cases. I thought this was all going to be Long Island. And you ended up covering some cases that we've covered on this show. And I have some suspicions about the Long Island serial killer case. And that stems from one of the cases you covered when we covered the West Mesa body pit case, or bone collector, as he's been referred to. One thing we were able to point out on our show was that out of the 11 victims found, five of them knew one another. We were able to connect the five of them. And I have a suspicion that with the Long Island case, if we can, let's take a leap here and think and say maybe one person did all of these murders. Well, that's a lot of bodies, right? It would be hard for me to believe that some of the victims did not know the killer. And I don't mean that it was like a boyfriend or a best friend or somebody that they had a long-term relationship with. I'm talking about maybe it's a frequent customer or somebody that they had known from the area. There's a reason why some of these girls went with this guy. And that leads me to my other suspicion regarding the Long Island case, is that maybe, and I don't mean to discredit your web sleuther who said that we probably have a torso killer in the area. We very well may have. But
just to be clear, in the documentary, one of the web sleuth guys, he comes out saying, hey, look, there's a chance that there's not just one killer, that there's possibly two. And his evidence of that is that there's a torso killer. Right, and he believes that there's a torso killer. So if you go with one being a torso killer and one just being dumping of bodies and not cutting them up, then we have two killers.
Right. And I would suspect in either situation, you know, whether it be two killers or whether it be one, that the difference in how they're leaving the bodies to me points out that there's some way to trace the murderer from the victim. And what I mean by that is, if you essentially, the torso killer is taking these bodies apart. He's removing all the identifiers from the body and he's just leaving a torso. So therefore, if you need the hands or the eyes or the face or the head to identify the body, if you can't find those, you can't identify the torso that I had to get rid of. Right. So therefore, to me, placing a torso in a rubber tub and dropping it off of a trail in a park somewhere just seems to me like a quick way of getting this thing out of my car and leaving it somewhere. And furthermore, I don't really care if it takes you 3 hours to discover what I have left here in the park or if it takes you 3 weeks, because you cannot trace it back to me.
Well, and yeah, my thought too on, you know, I think it's crazy to think that a killer can't change. We've seen it multiple times in the past where, you know, somebody might kill somebody with a gun and then kill all their other victims with a knife. So, you know, this idea that these serial killers never change, they always kill the same way, that just, I think, historically, that's been proven false.
Well, actually, you're exactly right. It's been proven time and time again that most of them do change. They adapt. And here's what typically happens in these cases where you have a span of many bodies over the span of many years. Right. So what typically happens is either A, they get better at what they're doing and they improve and they get harder to catch, or two, they're something outside of the actual act of killing has changed in their life. Maybe at one time that they lived with other people. Right. So they had to dump in one way and now they live alone and they have different means and they have more time and more privacy to do whatever they need to do. That's one way they change. Another way that they change, we saw it with Ted Bundy. He just starts losing control and he's just becomes a frenzy killer after at some point. He's less thought out and he's just disorganized, where beforehand he was very organized. And another situation we've seen in multiple cases, and this happens a lot, is they start to get lazy. They think that they're good at what they do. After a few bodies, they've not caught me. I've been out here running around for years. They've not caught me. There's no way they can catch me. They don't even know what they're doing. I don't have to make the extra effort anymore.
You know, that's a very interesting point. Number one, you know, I'm now, you know, I haven't said this publicly before, but, you know, now kind of thinking about the one killer, maybe he did get lazy, you know, just like Rifkin, you know, was cutting up at first and then decided not to. You know, there was, look at the care how dismembered they were earlier, and like even how of the dismembered victims, how they started to be less and less dismembered. You know, there's that, and I think we may find out that actually, at least on the GB4 side, that the girls may have worked together. You know, the West Mesa thing is very interesting, because we were able to find out that so many of them knew each other, but they didn't. But one thing we didn't go into on the show is some of them actually knew each other from, they all went to the same grammar school.
The thing that we were able to point out on our show and prove on our show, which was really cool, was that there was a caller who had called the mother of one of the victims. Now, the caller herself, she's a sex worker, and she tells the mother that your daughter is dead. She's been killed along with another girl, and they're both going to be found in the West Mesa body pit. And it turns out later that this girl that had called, she's found in that same pit as well with those other two girls. So it's easy to link those three together. And when we were
And the big question is how did this lady know to call the mom of the victim?
Right.
And then who did she know to get this information from? And then how the hell did she end up in the pit?
Exactly. The crazy thing here, though, is that we were able to prove that she knew at least two of the other girls. So you were pairing five of the victims together and proving that they knew one another. Furthermore, the girl that called, that ends up being found later.
Yeah.
The last time she spoke to her parents before she was reported missing, she had called them and she was very excited. She had a new boyfriend. He just got out of prison. They were going to run away and get married together. And she never identifies the boyfriend. The parents never meet him. We don't know his name. However, it's after this phone call, a few months later, she's reported missing. And then after that, she's found in the West Mesa along with these other girls, two of which she named by name, and five that were all linked together per our show.
Well, let me just give you a little bit of advice this year in 2017. If you start dating a guy and he's the love of your life and he just got out of prison, don't tell your parents that part. Okay? That's not good.
Or at least tell his name.
Yeah. Or make sure you get his fingerprints.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and did you see the latest developments in the Mesa case from a couple of months ago?
Not really for sure what you're talking about.
I'll fill you in real fast. So with Lorenzo Montoya, who a lot of people think is you know, the number one suspect who is conveniently killed or dead. So just recently, some journalists put pressure on the records department at Albuquerque Police Department and got released some videotapes of from Lorenzo Montoya. And the news released them, and it's Lorenzo. You can't see him. And what they released was like a static photo, like a static video of like his bed and side table, and then of the sound of what sounds like duct tape being pulled. So the idea is that he was there with some women. They actually released photos of these women too. And that, you know, we know he's killed in the past. This isn't, you know, evidence that he is the killer, but it does exhibit that if that sound is correct and it's duct tape and you hear garbage bags, that, you know, he might have been involved in some other nefarious activity other than just the one murder that we do know he committed.
Well, all right. But just between me and you and everybody else that's going to listen to this case, I really don't get the vibe that they're actively investigating the West Mesa case. I feel like in this case, what has happened here is that they discovered all these bodies. They spent a good year or two working the case. They have a suspect who's dead. They have a suspect that is behind bars for another case. And I feel like here they're just saying, okay, well, that's going to have to be good enough.
Well, and then we see this all the time when there's a bunch of sex workers that go missing. They do because of the public fear, because of the public outcry. Yeah, they put a little work into it. But once it goes out of once the public isn't talking about it anymore, I think they really just throw up their hands and they go, look, these women were putting themselves in danger. So, look, they're sex workers. We're not going to spend all this time and energy to try to solve their murder.
I mean, the weird thing is we actually got that on film where, like, we were, that's where we, like, make the phone call to like the hotline because they weren't speaking to us. So we were like gonna call the hotline to like try and speak to them, but we couldn't even get through because both of the numbers were down. And so we were frustrated that they weren't gonna speak to us. But then you know, you see like, oh my God, guys, like, you know, your hotlines aren't even working. I mean, how much work does it take to do that? I think Albuquerque is a tough place.
Yeah.
Albuquerque is a really tough place. You know, they've had some real issues with their law enforcement. We've spoken to the law enforcement since then, and they've kind of been like a little bit like reactionary to maybe at least take our phone call.
Yeah.
And it like seems like they want to do something, but it also is a systemic problem of just the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, and then with a case as old as the West Mesa case and everything they fucked up from the beginning, looking into that case, and that they've been, investigated and still are by the Department of Justice, not for this, but for other civil rights violations. In the course of investigating this kind of case with so many victims that's so old, you may come up with something that's not going to reflect too good on yourself as a police department. And I think that's always a concern when maybe there's been 2 to 3, different kinds of leadership going on over the past decade. You don't want to look like you didn't do your best, even if it maybe was the responsibility of your predecessor.
Right. I think that's what we're finding in a couple of these cases. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one thing, like, sure, they want to do the work, but they're also a little afraid of what they might
find.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then they're going to have to, like, publicly be like, ugh, you know.
I don't mean to change subjects here, but regarding the Long Island case, there's a part on your show where you're interviewing either the new chief or the new commissioner of police, and there's discussion of an FBI profile regarding the Long Island serial killer. And he has said that he's going to seek that out and have the FBI do it. And has that been addressed? Has it been presented to the public?
It has not been addressed. Did he promise to deliver it to us? Because, hell, I'm going to call him back.
I don't, from my recollection, he didn't promise to deliver it to us. He said that a profile is going to happen.
Doesn't
mean they have to share it with anyone.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, and one of the biggest updates in this case since the documentary, The Killing Season, which is on Amazon. You can check that out now on Amazon. I'll put a link again in the show description. But one of the big things that came out was the police chief. It has some charges against him. He's in a little bit of hot water. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So this was interesting. Rach got a tweet from a woman who claimed to be a sex worker. And we met her kind of clandestinely in this car. And she told us that she allegedly had sex with the former chief of police at a house in Oak Beach. And, you know, police officers and sex workers, you know, it's not the craziest thing in the world for them to have sex. But I guess the point was they had sex in the bathroom of this house, basically 4 miles away from where 11 bodies were found, basically 4 months after. So not only like, you know, you're just literally, you know, you've got so many bodies of sex workers found, and here you are, a police chief having sex with a sex worker just like around the block, literally, and just a couple months later. And it's just, well, number one, it's kind of tasteless, you know, and beyond the bounds of like, you know, what you should be representing as a police officer. But to kind of do that kind of sends a different message of, you know, you really don't care about what's going on. And so there have been a lot of talk on West Sleuth and a lot of other places that, you know, the police chief, you know, he has already been incarcerated for violating a guy's rights. A guy basically broke into his car. At the time, he was a heroin addict. We've told that they would actually break into specifically police cars to steal drugs because sometimes the police officers have drugs in their car from evidence or what have you. Yeah, confiscating it. So they knew what cars that they were getting into, and they broke into this police chief's car, and inside the car they found a duffel bag, and inside the duffel bag they found this, like, quote-unquote nasty porn. We're not quite sure what nasty porn means, but it's got to be pretty nasty for someone to call it nasty porn. So take your own inference there. So the police chief goes to the guy's house as, like, he's being arrested, takes the guy and, like, starts beating the shit out of him, and this mysterious duffel bag disappears, and the porn disappears, which gives you some indication of maybe what we're looking at. And then it suddenly comes out that this guy had been doing a lot of other things. He had been surveilling some other detectives. He and the DA allegedly had been in cahoots, and there had been all this talk about this guy was running a sex ring, and he was a police chief, and, you know, to the point where people were, like, saying, oh, my God, this police chief is the Long Island serial killer. That was just kind of nuts, but, you know, we now have a sex worker who's corroborating that she did have sex with this police chief, you know, not too far away, just really close.
And so let's just be clear for a minute, because with these allegations coming up with the sex worker, she's saying, hey, look, I had sex with the police chief, right? And I had sex at this party with the police chief. And we don't know if it was, we're assuming that it's paid for, mm-hmm. right? So, and what we do know about the Long Island serial killer case is that we have Shannon Gilbert, which was at a party.
Yeah.
And she, something goes awry. She leaves the party calling 911 saying, they are trying to kill me.
Yeah.
And then her body is found months and months or years later.
Yeah. And it's debatable if Shannon Gilbert's even a victim of the Long Island serial killer here. But we have, you're talking about a sex party or a party where we're being entertained by a sex worker. The former police chief has sex with her in the bathroom at this Oak Beach party. And we're talking about Shannon Gilbert being present at an Oak Beach party. Now, obviously, these are two completely separate different parties, but we have a situation here where Joe Brewer has been investigated, mm-hmm. and some people say that he's been cleared of any responsibility yeah. in Shannon Gilbert's death. But the problem here is we have additional people that are at that party. This wasn't just a Joe Brewer party. This was multiple people at the party, and we have unidentified persons at this party because Joe Brewer was not investigated until well after the fact.
Right. So one could speculate that possibly what if there was the police chief at this party? And if the police chief was at the party and Joe Brewer's cleared, that maybe Joe Brewer shouldn't have been cleared.
Yeah. Maybe he's only cleared to cover up for the unidentified persons that were at the party. And this also points out a frequency in these type of events going on in Oak Beach.
Mm-hmm. And like we also said, a lot of these victims of the case, when their friends and family are being interviewed, they were saying, look, we're going out to these parties or going out to meet somebody. And it's and the amount of money is way higher than it should have been. Mm-hmm. It, almost like a lure. And maybe it's just this sick sex ring where they're using these women and they don't care about them. Then they're disposing of them because they are people of power. And so that's kind of where we're at with this.
You know, that's coming from one source. Now, of course, we've continued to hear these rumors year after year. This is the first person who's come forward. But to kind of legitimize her statement, more people need to come forward. And more women need to come forward.
We think they are
We've heard, not rumors, but murmurings that, and it's a scary thing, right? If you're a woman who is going to allege that there were these sex parties with probably drugs with powerful people in law enforcement.
Yeah.
That's really, what are you going to benefit off of that?
Yeah. So it sounds very much like a movie. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like why we didn't want to put too much credence in it. Also because we thought it took away from the real investigation.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, something is rotten in Denmark. And the unfortunate thing is this is what happens. And I'm probably going to be wrong, spectacularly wrong here. Mm-hmm. But this is what happens in a lot of cases where, you know, you've got police officers or in this case, a police chief doing really bad things. And it ends up tainting the rest of the investigation. So people start kind of going off on the conspiracy route that maybe this guy's the killer or something like that. And it's not that this guy's a killer. It's you know, these tragic events and ends up kind of bringing out everybody's dirty laundry. And that's definitely what's happened here.
Yeah.
Okay, so Joshua and Rachel, with all these new developments, what do you think that this is going to lead to?
I mean, I am less interested in the sex parties at Oak Beach. It is interesting. Maybe there is something there. I'm more interested in identifying these unidentified victims. I think that's probably the biggest possibility to create a timeline by. If you identify them, you're creating a timeline. You're building up that narrative to then go backwards and, you know, cross-reference. If, you know, maybe there's a digital footprint. We don't know. We don't know because we don't even know who they are. So moving forward with trying to ID Peaches, trying to ID Asian male, which we've been working again with Todd, hoping that we can do something there. There's still Jane Doe number 6, still Fire Island Jane Doe. Who am I missing?
Jamil,
and then cherries, and then
yeah. I mean, look, that's the problem. We believe in this case that one of the best things to do is concentrate on the missing and unidentified, on mm-hmm. the unidentified, not on some of the other stuff. But I understand.
The other stuff is sexy and you know exciting and titillating, rather than just IDing some person. It's really sad and tragic.
Yeah.
It's not sex parties and blow in Long Island.
Right. But, I think the most interesting thing is all the people who are now talking about this case.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, like, it takes the show, and then the show sparks this, and then somebody else does that,
yeah.
And, it just requires a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of coverage, basically. I mean, this is why we continue to do shows like yours, which we think is great. You know, it's about reaching out to the people who want to see these cases get solved. And we really believe at this point in the power of crowd sleuthing, whether it's Web Sleuth, Doe Network, Charlie Project, whatever. But, the answers are out there.
Well, your show has brought this case to what I like to call present day sleuthing, to present day true crime army. It's more than just old people sitting at home watching Dateline. Our show is very interactive with our listeners, and we get tips from our listeners as well as theories and case suggestions. And we love all that. We love having that interaction. We feel like we're one big army of ants working together collectively with one consciousness.
Yeah, and what we're working on right now, and the thing that you're spearheading, we're hoping to prove something.
Yeah.
In a case that we covered. And if we can do so, then we're a part of a bunch of this happening. It started primarily through Serial.
Mm-hmm.
And by bringing that to the conscious forefront, and then look what's happened with that. And if he gets a new trial, or if they offer him an alpha plea, that is directly linked to the public pressure,
yeah,
I believe. And then if you look at other shows like Missing Mara Murray, a show dedicated to one case and what they brought to light as well. And, again, with the Serial case, you got Undisclosed mm-hmm. and Truth and Justice and stuff like that. And if it wasn't for this collective, there wouldn't be motion in a lot of these cases.
Right. They would be still standing still. They would be colder than ever. And what's great about The Killing Season is they went out of their way and championed a place like Web Sleuths and brought them in. They brought them out from their basements, and they brought the Web Sleuthers out from behind their computers and put them in the forefront.
Yeah, they're not trolls.
They put them in the forefront of the investigation and allowed their opinions, their theories to be voiced, as well as, there was such good speculation from some of these Web Sleuthers on this case. And I think what you're going to see here, Captain, I think you're going to see this type of thing trending upwards where, and one can only hope so, where we're going to see the documentarians working with the armchair detectives. We're already seeing podcasts working with armchair detectives, and we're going to start to see law enforcement working with the whole group, with the documentarians, with the podcasters, with the web sleuthers, with the armchair detectives. And it can only bring good. It can only help the cause.
Yeah, and one of the things that are interesting with what we're working on right now is at first we kind of felt silly, like, oh, we're just a true crime podcast. Like, are any of these detectives going to take our thoughts serious. Now, we got kind of lucky because we have a detective friend that, you know, we could drop his name and that kind of helps. But I've been really surprised lately with your theories on this case. And I'm sorry that we're kind of being secretive about it. But
we're not talking about the Long Island case. We're talking about a case that we've been working. But we've gotten lucky that there is a cold case detective in Columbus that's been interested in talking with us. And we've spoken to him in the past about a previous case to gain some knowledge. You got to shake some trees and see what falls out, right?
Right, right. And I think the smartest people know, especially when you're in a room of a bunch of people, that, you know, if you're a smart person, I believe that you're well aware that the answer might not always come from the smartest person or from the expert. You know, normally when they have these cases, you know, it's an eyewitness or somebody that just saw something that comes out later and that opens up a whole nother can of worms. So it doesn't have to be an expert that solves these things. Because, I mean, look, I never was this true crime junkie. Now I'm a part of True Crime Garage. You know, I just did it so I could, you know, I know how to record audio, so let me get involved. And even this dummy, you know, has had some pretty interesting thoughts on some cases throughout our last 70 episodes or whatever.
Well, and the great part of it too is that these documentaries, you know, it was once that only the TV waves were reaching everywhere. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now we have all these great true crime podcasts out there that we have listeners in Russia, you know, and in Australia, in Germany, in the UK, in Canada, all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And what's great about that is we're finding that there's this community and they're everywhere, and that should be scary to the bad guys. It's going to get harder and harder to hide as technology gets better and as the community of these forces get better.
Yeah. So when you are diving into these cases, know that you might be the one that stumbles upon something that could make a break in something.
Working with the Web Sleuth community, and I know that they have a lot of good theories on this case. What were some of the better theories that you heard? I know you don't have time to investigate all of them. The threads on this case are amazing. What were some of the theories that were presented to you?
the two killers versus one, you know?
Right.
What else? Two killers versus one. Oak Beach. Oak Beach.
We went over that. Hackett, we went over that.
Yeah, Peter Hackett. Yeah.
Always law enforcement.
Yeah.
Always law enforcement.
Yeah, every one of our cases, everybody's like, must be law enforcement, must be law enforcement. And I think we might have touched upon this before, but it is very interesting, and I don't think we've ever quite nailed the understanding of this, but basically when you have a serial killer case that goes unsolved, that has a number of victims, the public typically needs an answer for why the case is unsolved. And we have this need to find a logical answer because if it's not law enforcement, that means that anybody can be able to get away with this. And so it's just very interesting how it's like a social experiment that people always say it is the police who are doing it. It becomes the most logical reason since the killer hasn't been caught. Oh, it must be a police officer.
Right.
That's very interesting. And of course, that came up in Long Island.
Right. And maybe if it's not a police officer, it's someone in power, someone with money, someone in some kind of control role. And that's where they're able to get away with it.
Right. Or the sex party thing. You know, it's interesting. You definitely see a lot of kind of urban legend, you know, mass hysteria things come up over and over again. I don't know. It was hard for us to really separate, you know, what's a specific theory.
Thank you for talking about these updates with us. Now, what do you think we can expect with this case going forward?
So I think we're going to be hearing there's pretty maybe new updates that are happening.
Yeah.
You know, the FBI is involved in the case. And so we know I'm excited. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what's new going to happen. But I think we're going to start to be hearing a lot of more updates over the next 2 to 3 weeks, right?
I hope so.
Yeah,
that's fantastic. We're hoping to hear some more as well. And who knows? You might find yourself in a situation where you got to pick up the camera and get back out on the road and do another show.
Well, I mean, look, if something breaks, we're going to pick up a camera and we're going to go.
Yeah,
even
regardless.
If we, you know, even if the show isn't active right that second. I mean, we did that 2 weeks ago going out in Long Island,
right,
with the press conference. So, you know, it's not other people who do documentary series. It's kind of you come in, you do your punch card and you care about the victims and their families. But at the end of the day, you go home and you leave it, you know, on the edit room floor, essentially. Unfortunately, and fortunately for us, it's kind of a 24/7 thing for us.
yeah.
We can't get rid of it if we wanted to.
Yeah, I know how you feel.
Thank you both. And I'll tell you what, if there's any more developments, let's get together. Let's do this again.
No, totally appreciate it, too. And, you know, everybody watch Amazon and then jump on Web Sleuth and let's see if we can solve this case.
Yeah, and Josh and I are Dance Macabre on Web Sleuth.
And we're also on Twitter. You can reach us.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of conversations going on kind of all the time with regards to this case.
So Josh is at Josh Zeman, and I'm at Mills Rachel.
All right, those handles again. Web Sleuth is at Dance Macabre, and then it's at Josh Zeman for Twitter.
And Mills Rachel, at Mills Rachel for Twitter.
So thanks again for talking to us, two of the coolest people in the true crime documentary world.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you both. It's been fun.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You too. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
This week's recommended reading is Slave Girls by Wensley Clarkson, who is also the author of Hell Hath No Fury and Whatever Mother Says.
Mm-hmm.
This is a plunge into a nightmare of unspeakable abuse and depravity. This book actually features several different cases.
Mm-hmm.
So check out Slave Girls by Wensley Clarkson. You can do that by going to truecrimegarage.com. Click on the recommended page. We got all of our books listed there. Don't forget about Lost Girls by Robert Kolker, which is one of the best books, is the best book about the Gilgo case and the Long Island serial killer. So pick up both of those by going through our Amazon banner.
But anyways, I'm going to leave you with this clip from this press conference about the accusations that this prostitute is making towards the police chief. I think you'll find it interesting. It's about 16 minutes long, but check it out. There's some mind-blowing stuff there.
Significant development in the Oak Beach, Gilgo Beach murder or murders case. That development is that an active escort here in Suffolk County has determined to come forward and discuss with the public that this escort met former Chief of Police of Suffolk County, James Burke, at a party in Oak Beach in 2011. And at that party, she had sexual relations with former Chief Burke, for which he paid. This is the first time that there has been an actual connection made between former Chief Police Burke, Oak Beach, and prostitution. It's the first time this has ever occurred, and that's why it is significant. Up until now, there's been a great deal of surmise about Chief Burke and his involvement with Oak Beach. We have circumstantial evidence that he had some knowledge of Oak Beach, his assignment, for example, to the first precinct in that area, possibly his assignment to the Marine Bureau in that area, and his connection with Dr. Peter Hackett, the former police surgeon of Suffolk County, who was the head of emergency medical services for several years back in the 90s. We now know, a new development has also occurred today. We now know that James Burke and Dr. Peter Hackett were in connection with each other, working with each other in the late 1990s with respect to Flight 800 and the crash. So they knew each other. They certainly had a connection with one another. And when you take that and combine that with the knowledge that we're giving you today, you'll see that these are significant developments down the road on this case. Jimmy Burke never mentioned that, his involvement with Oak Beach, in his sentencing to the federal judge when he was sentenced for the crimes that he has been convicted of and for which he is in prison. He never mentioned that connection. Now it is being made. To examine Jimmy Burke under oath as part of the case that I have brought on behalf of the estate against Dr. Hackett. He is no longer just conjecture. He is now a potential witness in fact. So I will attempt to cross-examine or examine former Chief Burke under oath as soon as the case that's pending in court is decided. So that's another development as well. Jimmy Burke, the same man who had porno in his car, the same man who was soliciting prostitution, the same man who was responsible for the investigation of the Gilgo Beach, Oak Beach murders, is the same man who met this escort in Oak Beach and solicited her and had sex with her and paid for it after the investigation had already commenced. So that's why we're here today. And without more than, I'm going to ask that Leanne be willing to answer any questions.
So you're alleging that these parties where Burke was at, where you were at, were other people there?
Yeah.
Were other law enforcement there?
I mean, I would imagine so. He was there. I mean, I don't know specifically, but I mean, I would imagine so.
But it was a party. There were numerous people
there. Yeah, there were numerous people there. I mean,
drugs?
Yes.
And so this party, where did this party happen?
Oak Beach.
Can you just start out by telling us the story of what happened, how you came to meet James Burke?
I was invited by a friend while I was at Stony Brook University. During the time in April, I was not at the university enrolled as a student. I was at another school. But I was still coming back to Stony Brook because I was going to be reinstated in September. And I went to this party with a friend, as I often traveled back up to New York because I didn't live here at the time. I lived in Rochester. So I came with a friend. And there were other girls there that I knew that I would rather keep under the, you know, I don't really want to reveal that. I was told by someone, because my area of study, in which I have my bachelor's degree from Stony Brook, is in, you know, crime, forensics, things like that. So I was introduced, I was pointed out to him. He was pointed out to me as a high-ranking official. No one really gave me his title, anything like that. So, you know, I continued to party, and I remember that the outfit that I wore was not really consistent with what you would see an escort wearing. I had on, I think, Abercrombie & Fitch cutoff shorts and, you know, just some stupid shirt and, you know, Converses. So I didn't really come across as anyone who was, you know, someone you could solicit for sex. So I remember walking by him and saying hello. That was pretty much the extent of that interaction. There was really nothing untoward that occurred at that point. I came back again in August for another party. It was at the same location. And at that point, I was dressed a little bit differently. I remember what I was wearing, and it was a little bit more risque. I had never, up until this point, ever accepted money for sex. This is actually my very first encounter with pay for, you know, sex. So, what I would like to add from the first party is I did see Jim Burke grab a girl by her hair and drag her to the ground. I don't know how playful it was or how aggressive it was. I don't really know. I wasn't right next to them when it happened, but I do remember that. She was an Asian girl. So the second party I went, I was a little more risque. I encountered him. We had a conversation. It wasn't really much. I was fairly intoxicated myself. I was not on cocaine. I've never done cocaine. It just, you know, a whole lot of booze. And I remember hearing that he was high up, and I figured, all right, this is my opportunity for, you know, a PBA card from a high ranking official. That, you know, that was just a joke in my head. So he started to do things like, as we were talking, he would rub his hand up my leg, which, you know, I mean, I'm a woman. I know when a man wants sex. So, you know, I kind of took the cue, and he kind of guided me to the bathroom, where we started to engage in sexual behavior. He was frustrated because he could not consummate the act. He began to get really aggressive. And he used the term that I was not a good whore. So at that point, he began to try to reach, you know, ejaculation through oral sex. But it wasn't really oral sex. It was more of him grabbing me in an aggressive manner by my hair, himself inside of me. Choking. I remember tears, not tears from crying, but tears from how aggressive it was. I was tearing up, and he still couldn't reach a point of ejaculation. So he kind of just gave up and threw money at me, which was my first encounter with getting paid for sex was with him. Now at that point, I didn't know that he was, you know, so high ranking. I actually went back to a police officer friend of mine later on and told him about the encounter, and he said that he referred to him as Jimmy. That was Jimmy Burke, and I said, "Who's Jimmy Burke?" And he showed me a picture, and I said, Yeah, that's him. And then I saw him again when he got arrested. I remember seeing him being let out in handcuffs and thinking, well, that makes sense because he's, you know, not a very nice person. I had called in a tip on an unrelated matter to the Gilgo Beach Task Force. I called in a tip a couple of months ago. I received a call from the detective in charge of the case, to one of the two. That's what they told me. His name is Detective Bertola. He actually revealed me to the person I tipped on. He revealed that I was the CI to the person that I called the tip in on.
I have a question. You were there not with an escort service. You were there just as a party.
Just as a party. But
right, so you were never affiliated with any particular escort service. Did you have knowledge, or did you know any of the victims of the murder?
I did not know any of the victims.
Were there other escorts at this party?
Yes.
How do you know?
I mean, now that I've been in the business now for 6 years, and in hindsight, I can look back and say the behavior, two women on another person's lap, being led, you know, leading into adjacent bedrooms and doing certain things.
But you're making an assumption. You don't know that the individuals were escorts. You didn't identify the women that were there as escorts.
I mean, if they walk out with money in their hand, doesn't that make them, you know, doesn't that make it more suspect?
Is that what they did?
Yes.
And did you invite
Cooper agree to a monetary amount?
No.
For? How much did he pay you?
He threw me like a wad of between $300 to $400. I can't really recall. It was just a wad. At first it looked like $100, and then when you know how sometimes when you have really crisp bills, you kind of push them apart and you notice that there are more underneath. That was the situation. And I was a little dehumanized, but kind of like, oh, well, I didn't know that I could make that money for 15 minutes of not doing much. So, you know, that's...
And this happened after the investigation was already underway?
This was in... the first time I met him and just, you know, in passing was in April 2011. In that area, April 2011. And then I know in August 2011 is when we had our mini trust.
Can you tell us what the Gilgo tip was that you wanted to tell police? That's unrelated to this?
The tip that was made to the police by Leanne was related to the Oak Beach case. However, it wasn't a tip about Jimmy Burke. It was a tip about someone else, and Leanne does not want to reveal that person. And it's not, it really would not advance the point that we're here for today.
And how do you characterize his behavior that night?
Aggressive. Aggressive, arrogant, untouchable.
Were you afraid that night, or now have you been afraid since?
Not until they revealed me as a CI.
When you witnessed him drag a woman down to the ground, and you say you don't know if that was aggressive or playful, I mean, were you alarmed? Did it look to you like something you should be concerned about?
Well, she seemed to be laughing, which was almost maybe that is consistent with his behavior. She has, you know, encountered him before, and that was something that it was consistent. He kind of just wrapped her like this and kind of like went like, you know, took her down, you know. I mean, it hurts more if you just grab by one strand, but he kind of like went like this and kind of dragged her down, and she didn't seem to be too frazzled by it. I mean, I would have been. She seemed to be more, you know, I guess, used to the behavior.
Has your friend that was there that night provided the same testimony to John?
They're not going to speak, but I have stated that I will take a lie detector test. I have no problem doing that.
And whose house were you at the night of the sexual encounter?
The house is she can identify. She believes she can identify the house, which was a large house, a year-round house, at Oak Beach, and it was adjacent to the beach. The actual person who owned the house, it's not all that clear at this point, and what she does know, she'd rather keep confidential at this point.
Until next week, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.